You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. And we are on location at the Slam Dance Film Festival headquarters on historic Main Street in Park City. I'm your host, John Wildman, and joining me this morning at Slam Dance and Sundance are my co-hosts from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. We are going to be talking about a film in the next section at Sundance, La Leyenda Negra. And let's start off by having you introduce yourselves to the audience.
My name is Patricia Vidal Delgado. I'm the writer and director of La Leyenda Negra.
I am Monica Betancourt. I am the main actress in the film.
You are the main actress, Monica. And we're going to talk to you about that. But first, Patricia, why don't you introduce our audience to the film?
So La Leyenda Negra takes place in Compton, and the main character is Aletheia, who is a teenager from El Salvador. And she is someone who's very politically outspoken, she's very intelligent, and she's fighting for her right to remain in the United States, and this is reflected in her involvement in the underground political organization, the Compton Black Bloc. And she's newly arrived at Compton High School, so despite all her brilliance, she's a little bit lonely. And it's when she stands up for herself in history class that she's noticed by one of her classmates, Rosarito. And so the film documents the burgeoning friendship and maybe a little bit more between the two girls.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things I love about this film is that the next section has traditionally been one of my favorite sections at Sundance. But sometimes I see films in the next section, I go, why is this film in here? It's got movie stars, it's got all kinds of stuff, you know, going for it. And this is not what that this section is meant for. It's meant for films like this one, where it's a striking vision, and we have, this is your feature film debut, I believe.
Correct.
And, you know, and that section is meant to introduce us to you and to you. And, of course, we're listening on the radio, so you don't see me looking at both of them separately. But it is, the story aside, it's also a very stylistically wonderfully done film. One, it's shot on black and white, and let's talk about that initially. Your decision to do that and why you felt that this film needed to be presented that way.
So La Leyenda Negra, it considers cycles of history and their tendency to repeat themselves. It references imperialism, colonialism, persecution of the other, intolerance and indifference, and it essentially asks the question, tradition or change? And so the idea to shoot in black and white stemmed from the French idiom, plus ça change, for me. And in discussions with my DP, he also thought it would be an effective visual choice because it reflects the polarity of choices that our main character has to make as a potentially undocumented immigrant today in the United States.
Okay, and let's talk to Monica for a moment here. Monica, you know, when you're in a film like this with a role like you're portraying, frankly, you're shouldering a lot by its very design. So, you know, but it's also exciting to, you know, to receive that script and go, I get to do all of this. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about going into the project, you know, the angst that you felt versus the excitement and how, you know, and how your director helped you navigate that.
I love the film. I love just when we got the script. I loved her message to what she wanted people to see. It was very challenging because I've never acted. Aletheia is different than I am. She's outgoing. She doesn't care. She speaks her mind, and I'm very shy. So I think with this film and with Patricia and everybody else in set helped me get out of my shell to show her what she wanted to see on the screen. So I feel like this film showed me a lot of things and kind of opened me up a little bit more to get out of my comfort zone.
And Patricia, let's talk about that a little bit too, because, you know, actors get to that place that we need them as directors to get to in different ways. Sometimes they're right there from the get-go. Sometimes they have to warm up a little bit. And, you know, and as the director, if you have more people in a scene, you know, you've got to navigate everybody so that they arrive in the happy place for you kind of in the same time. Mm-hmm. So talk about how you manage that with this particular group of actors.
So we had rehearsed a couple of key scenes before the shoot. And so I kind of already knew which actors were the ones who were happy to take the lead, who were maybe a bit more relaxed, a bit more confident, kind of knew what to do. And maybe the other actors that, like you said, needed a little bit longer to warm up. So then that way you just have to be strategic about it. You know, for example, if you have a scene with two actors and you know that one is more confident and a bit more ready to go than the other one, you start with their coverage first.
Right.
Just to give the other actor a chance to catch up. So then when you turn around for them, they don't seize up.
And Monica, you know, during that process, did you reach a point where you said, oh, this is how this works, you know, versus when you first started? Or was it just every day was like, oh, here we go again?
No, I want to say yes. At the beginning, it was still like, oh, this is all right. This is the thing, you know, we're doing it. But then, like, by the middle of it, I want to say I got more comfortable. I was more like, this is another day. Let's do it. Let's knock it down.
And so you're just going, you're like going, I'll do my lines and I'm going to go to craft services, get something to eat, and then we're ready for the next scene, right?
Yes. Can I take my break? I did my part. Can I go take my break? Go relax, you know, get in the AC because it was very hot. Get in the AC, relax, and then can I come back? So,
and within a week, Patricia has a diva. Great.
Yes. She looked at me like, what did I do?
Now let's talk about also, you know, as a first time actor, you know, again, you know, it's like, you know, you're not used to, you know, doing breathing exercises and warm up stuff and things like that. You know, a lot of it has to be instinctive. And so beyond, you know, how you're being directed, you know, how did you work within yourself to get to the place that you needed to be for this character?
Well, she has a lot of anger in her. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that she's going through, it's something emotional. That same year I had lost my father. So that's one of the things that, you know, helped me a lot get to most of the scenes that I needed to get there. Like for the scenes where I cry, it's something that, you know, I told Patricia, like, I can get where you want me to get. Give me a minute. So then, you know, I will take my breaks. And, you know, I love that Patricia's like, once I see you, that's it. You just start and we'll start recording. So that helped me a lot to know, to stay in that mindset and still be able to deliver my lines. I think a couple of times I did, you know, I forgot a line or I forgot something. And she's like, you know, don't even worry about it. Breathe. Take your minutes. We're ready when you're ready. So she gave me that time to get to the place where I needed to be in that emotional sense.
Okay. And Patricia, let's talk about the story of this film too, because it's, you know, we say something is timely, but this is, it's more than timely. It's like almost a crisis point that we're at, you know, because of the administration and how they're approaching immigration and that sort of thing. So talk about the kind of like the responsibility you feel as a filmmaker to go, I'm not just entertaining here. I'm really trying to dig into something. Talk about that.
So for me, I mean, obviously I can't say who in the cast, but we do have undocumented actors in the film. And for me, it was important to showcase their talent. But also there was that urgency of, you know, you see it in their eyes, you see it in their faces, the pain and the anguish that they're going through, because nothing in their life is certain. And the place that they've called home for most of their lives, they're not allowed to call it that. They're not wanted here. And it's something that when undocumented children or children that have DACA or TPS, when they arrive in America, their sense of belonging is innate. And it's only when they grow up that they realize that they're completely excluded from society. And then what they experience is a gradual unraveling of sense of self. And that results in depression, suicide, substance abuse, all these things that they really don't deserve. because it's not like when they were 2 years old that they could had the capacity to turn around to their parents and be like, oh, where are your papers?
Right. Yeah. And I always wonder with a film like this, you know, because again, you know, when you're making a film, that's hard enough. You know, it's hard enough to make the day, as we say, and, you know, and to get the shots in and cover all the pages in your script. It's another thing to have this additional pressure of going, we need to get this right. And, you know, and again, and there's a little bit of a mission to this. And can I assume that on the set that everybody was buying into that and with that idea of like, this is a little bit more important than just doing like, you know, a fluffy comedy or something?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that especially the HODs, I think that they all really understood the importance of the message of the film. And a lot of them are Latino. For example, our costume designer, Alejandro Madrigal. We also had our script supervisor, Samuel Temblador. And all of them, like, even if they themselves don't have immigration statuses that are currently under attack, they know people who do. They have best friends who are undocumented or have TPS or have DACA. And for them, it was definitely important to kind of raise awareness and increase visibility of the issue.
And then Michael, let's go back to you on this also, that you know, again, it's, you know, it's challenging enough to do this for the first time on a feature film and to play a lead role like this, but you're also playing a character that represents an underrepresented group, you know, and they're students that are trying to do the right stuff. They're trying to scholastically achieve and give themselves a future, and yet they are, you know, to way too many segments in our society in this country, are not looked upon favorably, are not given that chance. So again, it's like, you know, you're representing all that. So it's literally not just memorizing your lines and not bumping into the furniture, as Spencer Tracy once said. You know, it goes beyond that. So did you have those kind of thoughts, and the two of you have those conversations about that, or did you try to just keep it simple and just do my role?
Yes. I tried to do the best that I could. But also, one of my things was that what she visioned is what I wanted to give her. So if she wants this feisty, outgoing young adult fighting for what she knows is she earned, that's what I want her to see in front of the screen.
All right. Well, again, the film is La Leyenda Negra, playing in the next section. We've been talking to the director, Patricia Vidal-Delgado, and the star of the film, Monica Betancourt. It's been wonderful talking to you both.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
The Festival Daily Buzz would like to thank the following businesses for their support: Ketos Brewing, Pro Bar, The Market in Park City, and The Social Study in San Francisco.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman. I am joined on this segment with our show's producer, Lance Yuan. And this segment, where it's something we annually do on the Daily Buzz, and it's kind of a development roundtable that we do. And I'm going to let our guests introduce themselves. Lauren, you go first.
I'm Lauren Kushner. I'm the interim director of artist development at SF Film.
And Amy?
I'm Amy Hobby, and I'm the executive director of the Tribeca Film Institute.
Awesome. Again, we've had both of you on the show before, and again, this is something that I think we do need to do a checkup every single year. And it's based on how, because we have many filmmakers and aspiring filmmakers listening to the show, and it's, what are we doing right now? What is out there available? And we want to talk specifically about your organizations, but also in a general sense, because you're two leaders in this respect, of what are the resources that filmmakers can actually tangibly use to help get their films made. Amy, why don't you start?
Well, with Tribeca Film Institute, we have a number of programs. We do funding and mentorship. Our big flagship program is called Tribeca All Access, and it's for U.S.-based filmmakers who are traditionally underrepresented in the filmmaking space. So coming with that is $10,000. You know, you apply online, $10,000. We do both doc and scripted and immersive, actually. So we're a little bit genre agnostic. I think this is a way that we're similar in organizations. We host a three-day network during our festival for pitch training. Filmmakers do peer-to-peer pitching. We have speakers. And then there's 2 days of one-on-one meetings with industry, which a lot of organizations are doing now. Ours goes back to 2004. And we carefully curate industry. We do around 1,200 meetings over 2 days.
Damn.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Lauren, follow that.
At SF Film, the primary way we support filmmakers is through our grants and fellowships program, which is funding, and then a residency that we have in the Bay Area, where we have about 30 or 40 people who are live in the Bay Area, filmmakers that are there, fiction, narrative filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, those working on series and features. And, you know, we connect them there to mentors, to programming. There's a lot of peer-to-peer access and really trying to understand sort of what their needs are and how to connect them to the people that can help unlock whatever it is they need, whether that's on the creative side or the funding side. So we'd like to just kind of be matchmakers for them while they're really serving that role with each other as well. And then on the grant side, we give away about $1 million a year in grants, usually in grants that are about $25,000 or $50,000. So not something that's going to get the entire film made, but we're hoping will help filmmakers get to that next stage. Most of our funding comes in for early development funding and some for post-production, just because in the Bay Area we have such amazing facilities there. But the funding's really nice too, because we support a lot of filmmakers who are based in the Bay Area, but our funding is open nationally, if not internationally. So even though we're San Francisco based, last year, for example, two of our big films were The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which was such a celebration of our hometown, and Honeyland, a small film from Macedonia. So our work really gets to span that spectrum, which is exciting.
Lauren, I'm glad you brought up Honeyland, because you might be going to the Oscars.
We are, which is not something I think when you work at a nonprofit, you really kind of don't measure success by those things. I think, especially doing artist development, sometimes we'll have a group of grantees and, one goes and makes their film 6 months later, and, one will work on their script for the next 4 years, and one may decide they don't want to do filmmaking anymore. And I think for us on the nonprofit side, it's supporting each of them in that decision. So for us, yeah, thinking about the Oscars is just like it's just so not what we kind of go into these programs thinking. But I think really speaks to just the filmmakers. And I think for that film, we were the only U.S. funder there, and just the role that we can have of making introductions to the people that they needed to know to help get that film into the marketplace.
And both of you, both Tribeca and SF Film, has films during Sundance this year. Could you guys sort of talk about the films that you have and have worked with this year for 2020?
Yes. So we have three films that we've supported this year. Miss Juneteenth from Channing Godfrey Peoples, which premiered. And then we have Michael Almereyda's film Tesla, which premiered last night. And Arthur Jones' film Feels Good Man, which also premiered yesterday. And then in the talent forum, we have about a dozen filmmakers who will be taking meetings with the talent forum for projects that are in screenwriting or kind of production phases.
We also have some films here, but I can't think of them off the top of my head right now.
It's very early.
it's proving that inviting the executive director instead of the program directors is a better idea next time. We have a couple films we supported. We support a lot of Latin American films. So, I don't know. We have films here, and we have stuff pitching in the Talent Forum and filmmakers we've supported in the Talent Forum. Again, a measure of success for us is not necessarily coming to Sundance.
Right,
you know,
right.
The measure of success is, for us, sustainability of the artists, you know. And I think, like San Francisco, we support artists early on. And, you know, yeah, sometimes they finish the film. I think on average, when we do the early support, it takes filmmakers, particularly narrative filmmakers, I think I did the average, like 3 years to finish their projects
right.
from the time we support it. But we want them to have sustainable, come back again, build community, rely on each other in a more peer-to-peer way. So,
well, yeah, and which leads into something that I really want to talk to the two of you about. And at a number of my film festivals, we've begun introducing the conversation that we don't often talk about. In fact, we never talk about, it seems, with filmmakers. And that is the fact that, you know, as they're trying to make their films, they're also trying to pay their rent. They're also trying to take care of their families. They're also trying to manage their relationships with their wives and their husbands and their boyfriends and their girlfriends. And while they're putting everything into this film. And, you know, and so psychologically, you know, it is difficult, and it's something because we're always talking about, you know, how are we getting the money to filmmakers, but we rarely talk about that support.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
So I would love for both of you to talk about that, because you are working with so many filmmakers and so many, and you're touching so many lives as they go through these projects. So
yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge economic barrier to being a filmmaker, and that's excluded a lot of groups and people from being able to make films, which ultimately restricts the kind of stories audiences get to see. And that's something we talk about at Tribeca all the time. New York City just now has a $15 an hour minimum wage, and we're like, well, that's great. Our filmmakers, particularly directors and producers, by the end of a project have not made minimum wage. You know, how can we work to support that and turn that around? And I think that's a complex question which Tribeca's looking to answer over the next 2 years.
And Lauren, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Amy. And I think when it comes to some of the nuts and bolts things, a lot of stuff, a lot of the conversations I'm having with our filmmakers too, is I think a lot of filmmakers, you know, come up and it's kind of the goal is to get to a place where they are making films as their primary source, you know, of, and I think, you know, their primary source of stability, you know, financial stability. And I think that would be, I think that's the ideal. But because that is so rarely achievable, even for some of the really sort of big independent filmmakers, I think for me, it's having a lot of conversations also around just kind of removing some of the stigma. I always like laugh when you're watching, you know, a camera commercial and you suddenly hear Errol Morris's voice asking them, you know, what the drive is like on the car. You know, that I think there's also, and there's also barriers to filmmakers, you know, particularly from, you know, communities that have been marginalized getting access to that type of work. But I do think that there's something of, you know, being able to, we've got filmmakers who teach, filmmakers who like to do branded work, of finding that sustainability, I think, is something that's really beneficial. And so that's something where we like to have those kind of conversations of bringing people in, of they're teachers and they love doing that. And it's like, here's the pros and cons to doing that versus somebody who may be taking on commercial work and how they balance their own things. But I think knowing that, like, that is probably going to be one of the pathways you need to sustainability is a good conversation to have, because so often I have filmmakers that come and they're like, I'm the only person dealing with this. I'm like, you're not even the only person today I've talked to the things they're dealing with.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's the thing. It's like, listen, I'm a filmmaker. It's been like 4 years between my first feature, but I'm also a publicist. And you know, yesterday I run into Michael Dunaway, who, of course, you know, has run film festivals, you know, is a journalist, and, you know, and he's also a filmmaker. And, you know, and we're all doing these things, you know, these myriad of things to pay bills and have a career. And yet we want to keep making movies. And the two of you are running to filmmakers that, you know, that are, you know, they're you know, sometimes, you know, they're baristas and whatever while, and then they go home and they're in their editing bay in their living room. And that's the thing, again, that I think we rarely talk about, is the fact that then, you know, they're like, well, I'm this is so important for me to make, and this is so important for me to get this off my back, and yet, you know, I've got rent. next week.
There's also a lot of false narratives that have been in the film industry for a long time, and I think that's what all of our similar organizations can be more focused about. You know, the idea of I'm going to use my credit cards to get this done. I'm going to sleep on someone's basement floor, and then it's going to come to Sundance and sell for $15.2 million. That is the exception, and that needs to be addressed, to, you know, so that you're, you know, that's not the way that it necessarily goes most of the time. I've had, like, I think 13 films premiere at Sundance, and sometimes it's been good for me, and sometimes we've left with nothing. So, yeah, I think that this that's part of getting on the radio, getting out. What you guys are doing, it makes that important, creating a more realistic narrative around what we do.
Well, yeah. You know, and again, we annually do this segment, and this is one of the segments where I'm hoping people are taking notes and they're writing stuff down. So before we wrap this up, let's quickly, how do filmmakers get in touch with your organizations?
Lauren, yes. So anybody can visit our website at sffilm.org/makers or email us at grants@sffilm.org to learn about our various funds that have deadlines throughout the year.
And Amy.
Same. You can go to our website, tfiny.org, and look through our various funds. We are updating our website in March, so don't, if you get lost in a rabbit hole, don't cry. Just you can find your funds. And, we have directors for narrative, immersive, short documentaries, and documentaries, and I think all of their emails are on our website, and they're very responsive.
And before I close, I also want to say, you know, I multiple times over the course of the year, you know, on my Facebook page, there'll be discussions with filmmakers and people in the industry, and they're talking about, like, resources and people talk to, and inevitably somebody will go, well, you know, do you know who Amy Ahabi is? You know, do you know who Lauren is? And you know, and then there'll be three or four people, yeah, and you know, and there will be a thing where they'll be going, well, look them up, and you know, because that's the person you need to talk to. So again, it's been wonderful that we've been able to talk to the two of you, Amy and Lauren. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The Festival Daily Buzz is brought to you in partnership with Films Gone Wild. You can find more info at filmsgonewild.com.
We are back on the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, and we have a special segment here. We've got our Kina Lorber team, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
I'm Richard Lorber. I'm the CEO of Kina Lorber.
And I'm Wendy Lydell. I'm the head of acquisitions and theatrical distribution.
All right. I want to talk about Kina Lorber specifically, but first I want to start off just talking about this year's Sundance from your perspectives, and you know, because I know you've been coming to this thing for a while, and we're always like going, well, how's this one different from last year's or past year's, what have you? So give me a little bit from your viewpoint of how this Sundance has been thus far.
Well, I'll let Wendy comment independent of what I'm going to say, but I think for us, it's been a relatively quiet event. There's concentration of interest at the very top end, and there's less of interest at the lower end. In the middle, the mid-ground seems to be wider, but there's no urgency in terms of many of the things that are available. We are announcing one acquisition here that we closed on, and we'll be talking about. It's a fairly, very remarkable Mexican narrative feature called Identifying Features, which will get, I think, a lot of attention. So we were happy to pick that up, and if we go home with that only, we'll be happy campers. We have a very full release schedule.
Right, our schedule is packed through May, so we're being very selective. But I think it's a particularly good year this year. I mean, the documentary competition has been fantastic, I think. It was interesting to me, there are a lot of films delving into technology.
There have been, we've been joking amongst ourselves because we watch so many films, for everybody that we're interviewing, and there've been a number of documentaries that frankly have just freaked us out,
I want to go home and go crawl under my bed.
Yeah, I had one film as I was watching it, I was deleting my facial recognition on my phone.
Right.
Another one, I'm going, okay, I'm a total sap, because I would have believed that too, and all these things are happening, and especially with technology and how it affects us, and how much that we have become the product as opposed to the consumers of the product and things like that. And narrative wise, there have been a number of striking things, both for Sundance and Slam Dance. It has been a rich festival in that respect. Now, the other thing I want to talk to you guys about is something that I think Kino Lorber does amazingly, and that is what you do as far as revitalizing titles and giving them wonderful releases on DVD and Blu-ray and things that when we see them we go, oh my God, yeah, I remember that, or I didn't even know that existed. And I'm one of those people that has the extensive DVD Blu-ray library. And there's all, and sometimes I'm teased about that by people that go, it's all streaming. I'm going, yeah, guess what? You know what? I have my library, and you may not have that streaming content at some time. That may go away.
That's correct.
Exactly right.
And so, but talk about it, because obviously, I think you guys are the leaders in this respect in many ways. But again, it's kind of like a delicate, fragile period, I think, for that model.
Well, that's why bringing them back is so important, because part of our mandate, I think, as older cinephiles, is to cultivate and develop the next generation. And by showing them the rich history of cinema, we give them the context in which to understand what's being produced now. Is that what you're going to say?
Well, I'll take it. We're very much a cinephile company, brand forward cinephile company. The headline under our logo is Experience Cinema. So as much as we're very engaged in the physical media business, which everyone has declared long dead, our business has been up every year for the past 10 years. It's key for us to keep films out theatrically. And for that reason, we release over 30 new films theatrically every year. And that has the halo effect of adding stature to the subsequent reissues of classic films and bringing those out on Blu-ray and now 4K HD. There's an awareness, of course, that streaming services are making fewer and fewer art house films, classics, foreign language films available. And every time one of the services goes under, whether it was Filmstruck or Fandor, there's the Twitter sphere lights up with people saying, damn it, I should have bought the Blu-ray when I could have. Of course, they still can from us.
Exactly.
And our direct-to-consumer business is the fastest-growing part of our business in the physical media sector.
Well, and that's why I was really looking forward to talking to you both, because that balance between what you do as far as new releases and that, I just wondered that, is there a by effect, a little schizophrenic nature in trying to balance those two?
Not at all. It's the classics of yesterday and the classics of tomorrow.
Yeah. I'll tell you, whenever I talk to or visit when I go to New York and visit my friend David Nin, who is, of course, is your publicist, I'm always going, hey, David, do you guys have this one around?
We're always open to tips, John. Let us know
But it is a wonderful array. Whether it's the amazing thing you guys did with the female filmmaker set with the Alice Guy Blaschet and other films like that, whatever, and then everything to the day after to everything in between. It really is. Again, for someone like me, I'm just like the biggest fan in the whole wide world. But now let's talk about the new releases and how.
One thing I want to comment on as a compliment to our physical media business is our recent launch of our VOD platform, Kino Now.
Yeah.
And on Kino Now, which is TVOD, transactional video on demand, not subscription. We're not selling subscriptions. We're selling movie tickets online, in effect, tickets to watch on your screen at home. Kino Now currently has over 800 titles on it, all our own. It'll have between 1,200 and 1,400 titles by the middle of next year. And we're in the process of setting it up. It's on Roku now. It'll be on Apple and Amazon shortly. But we're very excited about that. And it gives people the convenience of having them available on a rental basis as a preview if they want to eventually buy the physical or own the digital copy. So go to kinonow.com.
Knowing what you guys have in your library, that's awesome.
I just add one more thing, which is we organize Kino Now by playlists, and we now have a Sundance playlist with over 40 titles that were sourced over the years from the Sundance Film Festival. So you can go on there and click on the Sundance playlist.
Awesome. All right. We have one final question because we have to wrap this up. You guys mentioned that the acquisition that you've made. Talk about what you're looking for specifically, if you can, when you're doing a pickup out of a thing like Sundance.
I'll defer to Wendy since she's on the hot
seat. No, we're largely agnostic with respect to documentary, fiction, country of origin, format. We're passionate about cinema, and I think if we're passionate about it, we feel that our audiences will be passionate about it. We can champion it, and it's very much a gut cinephile first.
I'll comment that on the documentary side, we do look for films that identify an audience with specific areas of interest so that we can market to a constituency, which is less probable with the narrative film. With a narrative feature, we're looking for a strong authorial voice, an auteur voice, strong sense of style, and most of all, we're looking for true visionary cinema that pushes the boundaries and makes people wake up to the fact that cinema is very much an alive and future-forward medium.
Well, it is, of course, now we try to make this an annual thing with the two of you, that we get you guys in on the show. Because that viewpoint, again, to filmmakers that have been coming here forever, there's a little mystery element to it. They're going, what are they looking for? What is anybody looking for here? And so to actually have you guys articulate it is really important, and I appreciate it so much. Again, we've been talking to our Kino Lorber team, Wendy Liddell and Richard Lorber. It's been great talking to you guys.
Thanks again, John.
Thank you, John.
The Festival Daily Buzz is brought to you in partnership with Bitch Talk Podcast. You can find more info at bitchtalkpodcast.com.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and kcpw.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, and on this segment, we're going to talk about the film The Penny Black. We have the director, Joe Saunders, here, and the producer, Alex Greer. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
All right, tell our audience, what is The Penny Black about?
Me? Okay. It's about the estranged son of a con man trying to track down the rightful owner of a mysterious $1 million stamp collection.
You know, when I was watching this, when I first started watching this, anybody who's a filmmaker, had any aspirations to be a filmmaker, even just adjacent to that, has had that moment where somebody said, you should make a movie out of this. Mm-hmm. And we always have that. And that's why I was struck by the beginning of this initially, of that idea that that you guys are sitting around and talking to this guy and go, we should make a movie of this. And then you actually did.
Yeah.
So, and then it takes these twists and turns, but it's also, there's also a weird accessibility to it. Mm. And maybe it's because, I lived in LA and it's that thing of like going, yeah, dude could have been my neighbor, and that thing, could have happened. But talk about that. Talk about the initial diving into this, and then maybe one of you talk about the initial diving into it, and the other take the thing of like when you're midway of like going, how did we get into this thing?
Yeah.
Which one do you want?
I'll take the first one. When we obviously this story is extraordinary, And the hook is what happens at the very beginning. The strange man gave a possible $1 million stamp collection.
A mysterious Russian.
Yeah.
Right?
Neighbor, who he doesn't know, gives him $1 million stamp collection and then disappears. But when we started shooting, he was supposed to come back. So, you know, we started shooting a week into the 2 weeks that he was supposed to come back. And it just kept getting stranger and stranger. So it's what started as like a little slice of life in LA and isn't LA strange, became this really kind of dark, noirish story about this kid whose dad is a con man. And what is he going to do with these stamps? But yeah, it just kept going. I mean, we shot over a course of 5 years, and, you know, there were probably more opportunities for us to stop filming than to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing, and also, and the onion layers that you're peeling back are not just the subject. It is with your subject, and then it's with what's going on. So that's the thing that fascinated me. It's like, well, he's not just the normal dude that we thought when we began, and we're finding out stuff about him that bleeds into, you know, this thing as we try to find, you know, missing stamps, as we go to Arizona, as we go to all this stuff. So talk about midway through, like, where you guys are going, holy crap, what is this?
Well, yeah, I was gonna say, like, it wasn't a midway through thing. It was frankly every week or every point after we started filming this was a moment of like, what did we get into? Like, how deep does this world go? Every stone that we overturned at any point in the production led to like 20 more different rabbit holes that we could have gone down. I mean, there's over 100 hours of footage that we shot and probably like 12 other stories that would be equally as good for a documentary feature. Everything just kept getting weirder.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing that you know, as a documentary filmmaker, you know, you're mapping out your story. And I mean, we talk all the time about, you know, why documentarians get screenwriter credit, because you go, well, it's real. And you go, yeah, but you're shaping a story, you know. And yet in this case, there's also that aspect of what actually is real and are we being played and is this thing? Could talk about that part of it too from your perspective.
Sure.
Well, I mean, that was one of the exciting elements of the story is Will telling us the truth or not? And, you know, the way we wanted to shape this was kind of claustrophobic in that question, because we don't give a lot of outside opinion on what he's, you know, if he's telling the truth or not. It's just left to the audience to decide. And that's how we wanted to do it, because that was how we felt. It felt like it was up to us to figure out if he's telling the truth or not, without a lot of outside evidence. So it was tricky. And then, you know, and then there's Roman, who we didn't know if he's telling the truth or not. And there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of ambiguity in this, which is also one of the exciting things and why we kept going.
I mean, everybody that we came in contact to over the course of the production that is in the movie, it's questionable whether or not they're telling the truth. Yeah.
I mean, literally, even something as mundane as when you guys, like, you know, walk into the convention center to that stamp conference thing, whatever, and the guy you go up to, and even as he's talking, I'm like going, you know, is this guy going to try to scam them? And is that part of the fun of this? Of like going, is he leading us? Because
Stamp Show Steve.
Yeah. Because he's like looking at stamps, going, well, that one's okay. And meanwhile, he's going, if I can get that one, because they have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that aspect too? Like, you know, how much thought there was to, well, you know, we need to find independent experts and do this kind of thing, because you really kept it insular.
Yeah.
You really did keep it like, you know, like you guys were, you know, roommates, going down this, you know, journey, which dramatically was incredibly effective and incredibly entertaining. But then I was also thinking, yeah, but I mean, I wonder if on the side that we just didn't see filmed, like the guys are also doing research to verify stuff.
We tried to do some. I mean, like in the question of Will's father, for instance, Will told us that he's a con man who's like now living in England after some prison time, and is dying of AIDS and has come out as gay, and that in itself is not even like the main thrust of the film, but it's so extraordinary. Again, it's bizarre that this would happen. So, you know, once one of the stamp books goes missing, we started questioning everything he's told us, and we didn't. You know, we wanted to feel safe at least a little bit in the story we were telling. Even if he was lying, great. But how do we, like, catch him in that lie without, you know, losing our subject. So we did do a little research, and you know, there's his crimes are online, and you know, so we did that kind of stuff. And if it didn't make sense to put it out there and into the documentary, then we didn't do it.
And let's talk about the footage of Will's youth. And talk about the use of that and the process of making that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that is something that we did design. We probably spent the most money on that than anything else in the film. Just like creating the right period, and you know, I don't know if you probably
we hired like a wardrobe designer, production designer for it. Yeah. Our production designer found like a 1982 Macintosh that we plugged in and actually worked. That's one of my favorite shots in the movie when you can see like that 1982 Mac.
And we use the old video camera that I used to use when I was a kid. So that was exciting for me to shoot on that again and just like, you know, constant zoom in and out like everybody did when they had those cameras. But yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Well, that's the thing, you know, and again, it's always fun to talk to documentary filmmakers that have to do reenactments and have to film that, and because you know then you become a narrative filmmaker a little bit, and I always want to hear, like, you know, was that a pain in the behind, or was that playtime in the midst of everything else that you guys were doing?
Well, we shot that kind of documentary style. Like, a lot of times we gave the camera to the woman who's playing Will's mom, and I would just, you know, tell them the situation, and they would just kind of all improvise. And we didn't know if we were going to use the actual audio from that or not, and most of the time we didn't. But yeah, we just set the scene, set the rooms we wanted to shoot in, and just kind of let them go. And then we edited it like a documentary. There were times that the shots that I wanted to get and I thought were important to get while we were doing that, like, didn't even make the movie, because by the time we knew what the movie was, they didn't make sense in the movie anymore. Mm-hmm. So once we started editing everything together, I had this raw footage that was almost alien, just like everything else, and I would find interesting places to put it in the film just while I was editing. Like the cross between Will cooking and his dad cooking, that was not made intentionally. It just kind of happened in the edit.
Well, and let's talk about that. Again, you know, that editing process, you know, is, you know, key, you know, to you guys delivering the story that we want. And when you have that much footage, you know, again, you can go down. Oftentimes, you know, you can have three different movies, and so talk about that process, and you know, and if the movie that you wound up with was the movie that you thought you had going in, you know, once you began, you know, editing.
I think the strongest difference between the movie that we thought we were making and the movie that we ended up with is all about Will's dad. Mm-hmm. When we first started shooting, the thing that I was convinced would make a great storyline is when Will told us that his dad was a con man, and you know, and he wanted to be seen as honest, and like that was his whole drive in life. And I thought, okay, there's the internal conflict. Like, what is he going to do with these stamps? The stamps is an extraordinary story too, but what is he going to do with them? And how does that affect his relationship with his father? And so when we were first going through, I thought the father was going to be key in this, and we thought about interviewing him and, you know, getting him involved. And as we started going through and as we were editing that way, we realized that the story is really about Will. This is a character story about this kid, and yes, his father and who his father was affects his life and in this story, but it's not like a linchpin that we hang the whole documentary on. So the changes we made were like changing the opening from being about his father to being about Will, and the ending from being about his father to being about Will, and little, you know, bits in between.
And the last thing I wanted to talk about is, you know, when I have like you know, a filmmaking team like you guys, I always want to get down to the reality of who was doing what. You know, one of you is a director, one of you is a producer. But in a case like this, I'm assuming that the two of you are kind of doing everything. And one guy's doing the boom, one guy's, you know, holding the light and all this. Talk about the process of working together and how that worked.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of operate like, I guess, like the Maisels operated. Yeah. Like, Joe runs camera, I ran sound on set. I learned how to run sound. you know, the sound gets a lot better as the movie goes
over
the course.
As does the camera work.
Yeah, yeah. you know, we were both involved in the edit. We were both involved in crafting story along the way. I mean, it's basically just the both of us bouncing ideas off of one another. You know, Joe's the director on it, so, like, the final vision, he's the final filter on everything. But, you know, it was us putting up no cards together. It was us on drives back talking about story. It was us. We moved to London for a hot few months to edit. Yeah. Just sat in a tiny apartment and logged footage for
We sublet our places just to sequester ourselves to get the edit done because it had been going on for, like, the story had been going on for so long. And the ending we have, like, we didn't know that was going to be the ending because something we cut out was Roman told Will that he wanted to give him a surprise. And we were like, okay, well, that's the ending. Whatever this surprise is, like, what's he going to give him? And then, you know, he disappeared again. Right. So we were waiting for him, and we're like, this guy's never going to come back. So then we just ended it the way we did.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, again, the film is The Penny Black. We've been talking with Joe Saunders, the director, and Alex Greer, the producer of the film. Guys, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap on today's edition of the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This show is made possible with partnerships with the Slam Dance Film Festival, GoTo Productions, and KCPW Radio. In-kind donations are provided by Pro Bar, Keto's Brewing, and The Market, Park City. Our audio producer is Charlene Godo. Social media help was provided by Shoshana Howard. And assisting us in production are Chris Gardner and Brian Silverman. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Thanks for listening.